are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, December 15th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ian Millhiser, Justice Editor of Think Progress and author of Injustice, says on Fisher v. UT, the affirmative action case in front of the Supreme Court of the United States. Also on the program today, Bo Bergdahl to face a court-martial. And we're not sure, but we think Congress just ended the federal ban on medical marijuana for those states that have passed a law legalizing medical marijuana. Meanwhile, Seattle now providing a mechanism for taxi drivers and Uber drivers to unionize if they so wish to. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's still an election year. It's going to be for another year, if you can believe it. It's a two-year election year. Donald Trump surging nationally. Cruz, though, surging in Iowa, I should say. And tonight is the fourth or fifth, I don't know, maybe 10th, depending on how you count it, or 8th Republican presidential primary debate. We will cover it live in real time, ladies and gentlemen, with our own commentary. You can actually watch it
on majority.fm. Shh, don't tell anybody.
Trump also releases his health. He doesn't release his health thing. A doctor he pays says that his health is great. And the Republicans with a bold resolution in the war on Christmas, ladies and gentlemen, take to the bunkers as this Wisconsin parent did because their child read the words Islam in school. That's not an Onion headline. Ladies and gentlemen, just a little bit of house cleaning going forward. As you know, this is December, and you know that not because of the fact that we're all in T-shirts here, and my daughter insisted on wearing shorts yesterday. It's bizarre. I don't ever remember it this warm in the month of December, but probably has nothing to do with global climate change. But nevertheless, still a little creepy, and I'm being a little bit facetious. In fact, on Thursday of this program, Ben Adler, who's just got back from Paris, will be here from Grist, who will talk to us about the Paris climate deal. As of a week from tomorrow, that will be our last show of, or I should say our last new show of 2015. The dates are a little bit weird this year, so we may do our Friday show next Wednesday. just for giggles and other things. Or maybe we'll just do our last Friday show this Friday. I'm not sure yet. We will have best ofs following then. And you should write in and tell us what is your suggestion for a best of at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We are taking your suggestions very seriously, ladies and gentlemen. And we will get to that. We have a lot of things that we have planned for the new year, not the least of which is our new set, which we have been diligently building over the past couple of weeks. We're going to be announcing and launching a couple of new podcasts, at least in the new year. All of this is a function of the money we raised this year and via Indiegogo and your help. So I want to thank you in advance for all of that. And remind you that from a day-to-day, none of that money went to the day-to-day operations of this program. It's all a part of this build-out. So you can see we have a bigger staff than we did 3 months ago, and we are we're building out the set. We're building out some new podcasts. All of that is a function of the fundraising we did. But our day-to-day operations happens because of our members, period. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And buy the Majority Report blend. We get a kickback on that. And speaking of kickbacks, if you buy crap from Amazon this holiday season or at any time, go to majorityreportkickback.com. Click on our Amazon link, bookmark it. Always use that to buy your Amazon stuff, and we get a kickback. That's majorityreportkickback.com. Lastly, folks, I've told you this many times. Last night I did Chris Hayes' program. If you saw the show, you noticed two things. One, I have a haircut. Two, I was clean shaven. I'm not going to say where I get the haircut. Someplace in Brooklyn. But I don't even know the name of it. It's just the barber shop. I honestly don't. That's what I do. I go and I move into a neighborhood and I just get my haircut to the closest place that is less than $25.
Just like, hey.
Exactly. But last night I was clean shaven. How did I get so clean shaven? Well, you know the answer to that too. Harry's. They're about half the price of the other big branded blades, and they ship to for free to your front door. And these are not only the blades great, the handle is like it's a beautiful handle. And when I was younger, I didn't care about such things. But now it's nice to have, like, if you're going to have one razor, why not have a nice one? You know, why not just make yourself feel good about shaving in the morning? Or in the afternoon, or, you know, sometimes I shave at night before I go on do Hayes' program. And certainly, and beyond that, why pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades? If people shave on a regular basis, what does that get you? Like $200 a month or something. I don't know. I don't shave that often. The starter set is an amazing deal. For $15, you get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and 3 razor blades. And with the promo code Majority Report, you can get $5 off that for an amazing deal if it's your first purchase from Harry's. Nikki got one set for her brother. I got one set for her other brother. It's a great gift. And it's going to look like we spent a little bit more than we actually did, which is always a plus. Go to Harry's. Nothing against her brothers. I'm just saying. They're not going to know. Go to harrys.com. Harry's will give you $5 off if you type in my coupon code Majority Report with your first purchase. That's harrys.com. Enter coupon code Majority Report at checkout for $5 off. Start shaving better today. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, Ian Millhiser on the oral arguments of Fisher v. UT, the affirmative action case that will not die. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Ian Millhiser. He is the justice editor of Think Progress. But more importantly, well, not necessarily more importantly, but I think for the purposes of those who want a good long-form read, author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. Back in March of this year, we spoke to Ian. And I got to say, Ian, I'm going to start off in this way, and I don't want you to take this the wrong way because this is completely complimentary, but I was contemplating not having you on today because a lot of people have said that hearing about Injustices was a best of, which we would run starting next week. And so I had a dilemma, but I would just tell people, go out, read this book, Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. People know that in many respects, this show exists because in my mind of what happened in 2000 with Bush v. Gore. But all that said, welcome to the program, Ian.
It's good to be back. I got to say, I live in terror that the Supreme Court's going to prove the thesis of my book every day.
Yes, well, I mean, it is a legitimate concern. And let's talk about this. I mean, we've had at least two big oral arguments that I can just off the top of my head over the past couple of weeks. One was one vote, one person. I think we've talked about that on this program, but last week, Fisher v. UT. Tell us the history of this, because this seems to be like the case that will not die.
Yeah, I mean, this is the second time this case has been up to the Supreme Court. It's a challenge to affirmative action that has been spearheaded by this guy, Ed Blum, who's kind of the chief white rights activist in the country right now, who's constantly finding new ways to undermine civil rights laws. And I mean, ultimately what's at stake at this case is whether diversity is a virtue in public education. You know, the reason why schools want to foster diversity is what the Supreme Court said several years ago in the Grutter case, is that you have a better education when you aren't just, you know, being educated by good professors, but you're interacting with people who aren't like you. You know, if you are a white person and you go to a school where everyone is white, you will get an inferior education and you will be less prepared to go out into the world. And so that's why we want to have diverse student bodies. There are at least four votes on the Supreme Court that seem to feel that that isn't a virtue at all. And Justice Kennedy did a bit of a Hamlet act during the Fisher oral argument, but he has in the past shown a great deal of hostility towards this notion that we should have a policy that fosters diversity.
All right. So go back and just, you know, tell us the history of affirmative action beyond this case, right? Because there, you know, I've always been confused about the Michigan law school case or undergraduate case. If you could just give us a sense of the sort of the contours of that Michigan case, so we just get a sense of like the history of affirmative action.
Sure. So I mean, this is a 2003 case. It involved an affirmative action program that really only used race as a tiebreaker. I mean, what's important to understand about modern affirmative action programs, you know, they aren't quotas because quotas were declared unconstitutional for a long time. And they aren't policies where I think the misconception that a lot of people have is that they're policies where qualified white applicants are displaced to bring in less qualified applicants of color. You know, in reality, especially when you're looking at elite schools, they generally have many, many more qualified applicants apply than they have spaces for. You know, Harvard could probably replace its entire incoming freshman class with a different slate of kids, and those kids would still do just fine because there's a lot of smart people out there. And so affirmative action, as it generally operates, as it operated in Michigan, as it operates under this Texas program that's now being challenged, says that you can effectively use race as a factor on the margins when you're trying to decide amongst qualified applicants who you want to admit to your school. And you can do that again because, as the Supreme Court said in this 2003 case, you want to have a diverse student body. If you have a diverse student body, everyone who shows up for their first day for freshman year or everyone who shows up for their first day of law school is going to have a better educational experience overall because they'll benefit from the diverse experiences of their fellow students.
And we should say that when we talk about these things at the margins, we're also talking about geography, it seems to me. We're
right.
talking about some kids have, or I should say students have different extracurriculars. And also, I think in some instances, like, oh, your legacy, right? Your parents went here, or your brother or sister went here. That's also a factor, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the way that I think of it is, like, in a piece I wrote a while back, I compared it to an orchestra. And if you have a school where you have two people applying, they have very similar records, but one of them plays the tuba and one of them plays the oboe, and it happens to be the case that your school's orchestra needs an oboe player,
right,
then you pick the oboe player. And it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with playing the tuba. It doesn't mean that, like, we're trying to give some sort of unfair advantage to oboe players, but it's just a recognition of the fact that in an orchestra, like in, you know, a student body as a whole, you need many different people who bring many diverse skills to the table, many diverse experiences to the table in order to get the full experience that you want to create. And so that's how modern affirmative action programs work. As they look at the class that's coming in, and they say, you know, how do we build a student body that's sufficiently diverse that everyone will have a richer experience?
And I may be getting ahead of myself a little bit as we sort of analyze what happened at oral arguments. And I also want to get to the question of standing, frankly, too, because that seems to be one that is not addressed. But is that notion that a university education, that a college campus is like an orchestra, is that analogy accepted? In other words, I mean, I think there was an occasion in this argument of this case where Roberts seemed to dismiss that idea, right? I mean, this concept that, well, that you get a benefit, like, you know, that it takes all instruments to make this orchestra. That's not what a college is about.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there was one question that in particular where Roberts said, well, what on earth does diversity matter in a physics class? And, you know, he was trying to make this trite point about how there's no white way to do physics or black way to do physics. And I mean, as a narrow matter, that's true. But it's not like physics students live in cloisters where they, you know, they don't interact with each other and they never talk about their life experience. You know, the educational experience in a university setting goes far beyond what you learn in the classroom. A lot of it comes from the interactions you have with your students. And if you are a physics student, you know, chances are you're not going to stay a student for the rest of your life. Chances are you're going to go out into the world. You're going to go into industry. You're going to business. You're going to government. You're going to go into something. And when you get there, you are going to find a whole lot of people whose lives did not look like yours. And if you have a colleague who has a different racial background, or you have clients who have a different racial background, or if you join the military and you serve with people who have a different racial background, you are going to do better in the world and be better at your job if, you know, you have already been through an educational experience that, you know, where you are accustomed to racial diversity.
But let me ask you this too.
Okay.
Like, where does, what I don't understand is, like, where does a Supreme Court justice in this instance, right? I mean, because this is a policy that's adopted by the universities, right?
Right.
I mean, where does the, And maybe this is just because we're talking about state schools on some level, but where does a Supreme Court justice, where does it come in that they determine what type of education the university is providing? I mean, I suppose, you know, you could argue, a university would say, like, yes, there is no black way or white way to do physics, and we really discourage any socialization or any conversation outside of class. We've actually built tunnels so that people go directly to the physics lab and then directly are sent out to the gates of the university, and that's the only thing that they do. I mean, it's not a school I would go to, and it would seem a little ridiculous, but why can't the university simply say, no, this is not controversial with us? We see our mission as to educate the whole person, not just their narrow class syllabus.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Texas should have, you know, the University of Texas should have a fair amount of control over its curriculum and over how it wants to carry out its methodology, you know, how it wants to carry out educating people. That said, it is a state school, which means it is bound by the Constitution. And so the plainest theory here is that the Constitution doesn't permit consideration of race really at all by any government entity. And since affirmative action programs necessarily require you to at least consider someone's race at some point in the process, they say that that's unconstitutional. What the court has said in the past is they said, yeah, it's true that the Constitution really doesn't, you know, is skeptical of racial classification. But it's skeptical of them for a particular reason. It's skeptical of them because we don't want Jim Crow. We don't want efforts to create an underclass. And that's not what this is. This is an effort to lift up the educational experience of every student, black or white, who attends the University of Texas. This is something that cannot be achieved unless you pay attention to racial diversity. And the court has said in the past that the government has a sufficiently compelling interest in, you know, in achieving that it overcomes the Constitution's ordinary bias against racial classification.
Okay, so Roberts is then questioning not that the state, as it were, has the right to if there's a compelling interest to recognize race, but rather questioning whether or not this is a compelling interest, a rational compelling interest.
Right. Well, I mean, in Roberts' case, I mean, Roberts is maybe the biggest hardliner on the court when it comes to racial issues. I mean, Roberts is impatient for the day when we don't have to have all these silly civil rights laws roaming around. He's the guy who wrote the Shelby County case, striking down the much of the Voting Rights Act. And I think that he is, you know, particularly eager to have a world where, like, the government has to walk around like it's actually living in a Stephen Colbert joke. You know, I don't see race. I don't know that it exists. And I mean, there's probably three justices on the court who are pretty close to him in holding that viewpoint. You know, the one place where there may be some wiggle room is Kennedy is really conservative on race, but he's shown at least a little bit more capacity for nuance than Roberts has.
Well, I mean, I can only imagine the hardship that someone like John Roberts or Antonin Scalia have gone through because of all the black privilege that they have been forced to to compete with over their years. So I can only imagine from their personal experiences. I mean, we'll get to Scalia's comment as well. I mean, this guy is really, it's really been remarkable. He's been able to go outside his house every day with all the oppression that he suffers. But all right, so let's get back to, so this case is now back at the Supreme Court really for the second time. And you basically say it's because Justice Kennedy is like the Dread Pirate Roberts. He just can't, what's going on with that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the Dread Pirate Roberts joke I made, of course, if you've seen the movie Princess Bride, every night he says to his assistant, I'll probably kill you in the morning, and then he never does it. And that's the relationship that Justice Kennedy seems to have with affirmative action, where in the Michigan case, when Kennedy was in dissent, he wrote a very strongly worded dissent saying that he wanted to see these programs gone, at least the program in Michigan gone. And in the oral argument, the first time the Texas case was up, he was extraordinarily skeptical of the program and seemed very inclined to strike it down. And, you know, we now know based on reporting that he switched his vote midway through the first time around and decided to send it down to a lower court. Now, I think what happened is that the lower court he sent it down to was the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, which is extraordinarily conservative. I thought that Kennedy believed that the Fifth Circuit would do his dirty work for him and strike this wall down. He was stunned when the Fifth Circuit didn't do that. And now that it's up again, he was asking a whole lot of questions at oral argument about whether or not we could send it back down to a lower court again. So I think he wants the Texas program to die. I just don't think he wants to hold the axe. And the question is, you know, how long this silly dance is going to continue, where Kennedy, you know, clearly very much wants something, but isn't willing to make it happen himself.
I think there's a lot of people who are listening to the program right now, when they hear that characterization of the way a Supreme Court justice makes their decisions, I think they're probably a little bit shocked. And it would suggest to me, as I create the straw person, that they haven't read your book. But, I mean, this idea that a justice has an agenda but is being incredibly passive-aggressive about it because he does not want to be the guy who struck this down, right? I mean, that's basically it. He was willing to vote that way in the Michigan case where it was clearly he was going to be in the minority of the court because at that point, I guess it was Sandra Day O'Connor who was the swing justice. But this guy wants it. So what theoretically would his argument be as to why it needs to be remanded again? Like, what facts would be investigated according to him if we were to perceive him as being someone who is not just wants to see this die, but wants to see it die on the vine rather than having to sort of pick it himself?
Right. So, I mean, I guess what distinguishes Kennedy from Roberts, so Roberts just wants racial considerations eliminated entirely from the law. Kennedy thinks that it is okay to look at race in order to achieve things like diversity, but only if there is literally nothing else you can do. So, like, the state has to prove that, like, it tried everything else it could do, it didn't work, and finally this was the one thing that's left, so we're going to do an affirmative action program. And in Texas's case, things are a bit weird, because they have this thing called the Top 10% program, where most of the students who get to go to the University of Texas are admitted because if you're in the top 10% of your high school class, you're automatically admitted into UT. That actually does a decent amount to achieve diversity, although for various reasons, not enough, simply because Texas is very segregated by neighborhood. So, you know, because there's a lot of housing segregation in Texas, it means that a lot of racial minorities go to schools where almost everyone at the school is a racial minority. So if you're in the top 10%, you know, you get that's a ticket for you to get admitted to the University of Texas. Kennedy seemed to want more fact-finding on, okay, like, has Texas already done enough? Like, do they really need this additional kick for the small percentage of students who don't get admitted to the top 10% plan? Is there some other tactic they can use? And honestly, it wasn't really very clear at oral argument what he thought there needed to be more fact-finding on. I'm not really convinced that, like, there is much room for fact-finding on this case. I just think that Kennedy's looking for a way to make this someone else's problem, and this is an excuse for him to do it.
You know, this part of it really is fascinating to me, because just so that people understand what we're talking about here, this is where the legal principles meet the question of policy, it seems to me, in terms of, like, you know, where there are policy debates as to, is there actually an effective way, and not just putting aside the Constitution, because this is where the sort of the Constitution, according to these justices, allows for this to happen. If there is actually other effective ways of providing that diversity, and it seems to me, at least, that, and maybe I'm being too kind to Kennedy here, there is some controversy over that point. I mean, we've had Rick Kallenberg on this program in the past.
Right.
I think he was on, it was a while back, I think he was talking about unionizing as a human right. But he has been a very sort of, I guess, strong proponent of this type of replacement for race-based race accounting for formulas
right.
for creating diversity in place of this one. But the arguments, and this was brought up by Ginsburg, was that when you, and you've just stated it, but I think it really is important to sort of walk through this slowly. When yeah. you say we're only, the way that we're going to deal with this is by taking the top 10% of every school in the state, it creates, well, it creates some problems for other schools, perhaps, in terms of that might be seeking the top 10% as well in the state. But it also sort of relies on the fact that to the extent that this is effective now, we take the 10% because we know that schools are segregated by you know, because people live in different neighborhoods, like you say. It relies upon a perpetual state of school segregation, and it relies upon a perpetual state of segregation, you know, I guess not just in terms of race, but also in terms of, you know, a whole host of other societal ills that deal with
right.
education, because, you know, we often break things down in terms of race, in terms of where we're going to live, and in terms of services that come from certain areas. And that seems to be rather problematic, right? Because then you can't really form a principle, a legal principle, in terms of whether or not there's another solution, because, or you have to stop all the other things that you pursue as a society, like desegregating schools, maybe
right.
Decoupling school funding from things like real estate taxes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the thing about this, I mean, University of Texas is the most elite school in the, you know, University of Texas Austin is the most elite public school in Texas. And what we're talking about here when we talk about the 10% plan is essentially whether we can achieve integration, or at least some degree of integration, of the for the narrow band of students who get to go to this incredibly elite school, and do it at the price of having everyone else attend a segregated high school and having them live in segregated neighborhoods, and, you know, and all of that baggage that's associated with it. You know, this is an attempt to achieve justice by building on a massive systemic injustice. And on top of that, it in many ways undermines the benefits of diversity, for the simple reason that if you have a school where all your white kids, or almost all of your white kids, are coming from almost entirely white neighborhoods where they didn't interact very much with people of color, and all of your students of color are coming from neighborhoods that were almost entirely minority neighborhoods, whether they were black or Latino or, you know, some other minority group, and they're getting admitted by virtue of the fact that they were in their segregated neighborhoods. What that does, you know, you take all of these people where the white kids grew up in white environments and the black kids grew up in black environments and the Latino kids grew up in Latino environments, and then you bring them all together and it emphasizes their differences. You know, it means that the first thing that people notice when they meet a person who has a different racial background is this person has had a different experience than them. And often, you know, part of the benefits of diversity are that it teaches people where there is common ground. You know, it is useful to have people in your school who are black students who grew up in predominantly white neighborhoods, or Latino students who grew up in predominantly black neighborhoods, or white students who grew up, in minority neighborhoods, because, you know, that is part of the richness of our experience as well. And it's an experience that often helps us bridge the gaps amongst races. So, you know, the problem with just doing the 10% plan alone is you take people who have lived segregated their entire lives and bring them together, and, you know, you risk creating an environment where people are going to see differences more than they're going to see similarity.
And I mean, that's that is even putting aside the debate and controversy as to whether or not these programs as they stand now on their face actually have been able to maintain the same levels of racial diversity under the right. old affirmative action regime. I mean, you know, in that question, I mean, you're sort of like raising a theory that, you know, you want students and kids who have, you know, in some way functioned as, you know, I don't, ambassador is like, I think, too sort of inartful of a term, but have had a varied experience outside of, I guess, their, you know, that there's a varied experience within a varied experience, I guess. And you're eliminating that measure of diversity. I mean, this seems to be, you know, I don't know. If I give Justice Kennedy the benefit of the doubt, I'm saying, like, he would really like to see the data on that and see if what you're postulating is actually, if there's any social science data on that. You know, I mean, I think, you know, anecdotally, I think from my experience in college, when I think when I found myself in situations where I was a minority, not on campus, but, you know, let's say in Unity House or in certain, you know, I think in my college there was, it was a function of having friends who had, you know, were it was kids who had experience dealing with kids who were not the same as them, who ended up bringing together larger groups of people. But that's just anecdotal. All right. So
right.
let's move on to the question of standing, which seemed to have come up last time and now is sort of like just gone. Abigail Fisher, the woman who brought this case initially, who now may be a grandmother, for all I can tell. I mean, it was, I don't know if it was quite that long ago, but it seems that she really didn't have any standing here, did she? And why is that not an issue?
At this point, it appears that, you know, while she probably once had standing, she doesn't have it anymore. So standing is the rule that you can't go to federal court unless you've been injured in some way by the person you're suing, and unless the court is actually capable of redressing that injury, it has to be able to do something to cure whatever the problem is that you're complaining about. And in Abigail Fisher's case, her initial complaint was, I didn't get into the University of Texas, and I want to get into the University of Texas. That's the issue, is, you know, she's already got one undergraduate degree, she's not interested in another one, so it is no longer the case that if the court ordered the University of Texas to admit her, that would redress her injury. The only other thing she asked for in her complaint is, she said, well, I also had to pay this $100 application fee, and I'd like that back too. But she would have had to have paid that $100 application fee even if she had been admitted to UT. I mean, that's not something where, like, you know, she hasn't been injured because she had to pay the fee. Everyone who applies has to pay the fee. So, you know, the issue is just that, you know, because this case has gone on and on and on and on, the injury that she once experienced that gave her standing to be in court no longer exists. And, you know, some of the reason why this case doesn't, you know, probably shouldn't proceed is frankly due to the lawyer's incompetence. In past affirmative action cases, the lawyers have brought it as a class action and have said, like, we are bringing this not just on behalf of this one person, but also all similarly situated white people who want to apply and don't want to have an affirmative action plan. And that way there's still someone else out there.
Right.
Who has standing. They, for whatever reason, didn't do that. And because they didn't do that, their case had a time limit on it, and that time limit has expired. It, you know, it doesn't look like the justices are going to wind up taking that into account because it didn't come up very much at oral argument.
But why not?
But as a matter of the, I mean, standing is one of those things, frankly, that the justices love to bring up when they care to bring it up, when there's a case they want to see go away. But, you know, I mean, the Roberts Court, even though, you know, when I was in law school, I always thought that, and I was taught that standing is something that, like, conservatives want to view it narrowly and liberals want more people to have access to justice.
Right.
I mean, even when I was a young lawyer, I worked on a project that, I mean, the term that liberal lawyers used was access to justice. There were
right.
all kinds of nonprofits that had access to justice projects that were trying to, like, make sure that lawsuits could still be brought by people who were disadvantaged. And what's happened under the Roberts Court is that as the court has become more conservative and as, like, conservatives have realized that they have a lot to gain from a very aggressive judiciary, you know, the sides have almost flipped. And now conservatives, the conservative justices, are often very willing to accept theories of standing that I think they might not have been willing to accept 20 years ago because, you know, why not roll the dice on judicial review?
Right.
You know, if the Supreme Court is this conservative, you're probably going to get a result you like.
You know, I mean, I still am one of those people who I don't have that much of a problem with her being there. I'm just curious as to why that didn't come up. And there also is, I think it was ProPublica did a pretty in-depth piece arguing that, you know, she hadn't quite proven that she could have gotten in anyways, that it turns out like her grades weren't particularly good. But I mean, presumably, right, there is a Fisher out there that, and maybe her name wasn't Fisher, but there was somebody out there who could have made this argument. So I guess that's not such a big deal, I guess, in my mind, although it is sort of fascinating to watch, like, when standing is an issue and when it's not with these folks. But lastly, let me ask you this about recusal. There's one other
yeah.
sort of element to this case that is also sort of, I guess, problematic, particularly from the perspective of those people who think that race should be a consideration, at least marginally, in acceptance to, or it should be an element of what makes you a desirable candidate to get in.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that Kagan has to recuse herself. Tell us why
right.
she has to recuse herself. And then, if you can, and I know how you'll respond to this, but I want everybody to see it. Why is it Kagan's recusing herself when we have seen unbelievable conflict of interest
right.
with cases anywhere from the Affordable Care Act to energy, Dick Cheney's energy meetings,
right.
et cetera, et cetera.
Well, Kagan is in somewhat of a unique position because she isn't just a fairly new justice, but her job right before she got on the court was she was Solicitor General of the United States. And so the reason she's recused in this case is because her office was involved in the affirmative act in this very litigation before she became a justice. And when you're an attorney who has participated in a case, and my understanding is she didn't wall herself off in this case in the way that she walled herself off in some other cases. I mean, it's just a rule that if you're a judge and you previously worked on the same case as a lawyer, you have to recuse yourself. And that's a pretty bright line rule that I don't know that any of the justices have really, you know, wanted to play around with that. I mean,
but most
of them have been just.
Correct me if I'm wrong. There is no rule. I mean, that's a rule that is a rule for the federal judiciary, but there are no rules for the Supreme Court justices, right? I mean, there's just a broad principle.
Well, so there's two layers to it. There's actually a federal statute that says that all judges and all justices must recuse under certain circumstances. And one of those circumstances is that if you were a judge or justice who was previously a lawyer in the same case, now, I don't know that there's necessarily a consequence for the justices if they refuse to comply with that statute, but that is what the law said.
Okay.
There are then a list of guidelines that apply to lower court judges. and are considered optional for the Supreme Court. So for lower court judges, if the judge's actions would like create a cloud of controversy over the neutrality of the judiciary, a lower court judge is required to recuse. A Supreme Court justice, it's basically their call. And so it's in those cases on the margins that are governed not by that one statute, but by those guidelines where the justices basically have free reign. And that's where you have, you know, Justice Scalia going duck hunting with Vice President Cheney while Cheney has a case pending before the court.
Or I guess Clarence Thomas's wife working for, you know, entities that would benefit if the Affordable Care Act was rolled back, et cetera, et cetera. All right, so
yeah, and I mean, I'll push back. I don't want to give too much of a robust defense to Clarence Thomas, but I will say that, like, feminism requires me to say that Ginny Thomas gets a career, you know, and Ginny Thomas's career option shouldn't be limited because her husband also has a job.
Well,
and so
her career is not limited.
There,
well, her career is not limited. It's just his. I mean, we could say the same thing about Kagan, right? I mean, you can't limit her career as a solicitor general because of you know, what she might ultimately do if she's successful. I mean, it's just a question.
Well, I think.
No, I mean, like Scalia. I had an issue with Scalia's son working on a case that was in front of the Supreme Court too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any question that if a relative is actually working on the same case, that the justice has to recuse. So if it's the same case and Eugene Scalia signed a brief, then Justice Scalia has to recuse. With respect to someone like Ginny Thomas, Ginny Thomas has worked as a lobbyist.
Okay.
So if Ginny Thomas is actually lobbying to repeal a bill that comes before Clarence Thomas, I think Clarence Thomas needs to recuse. But if she just has a viewpoint, she's allowed to have a viewpoint.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. You are also like a wise Solomonic, is that the right word, arbiter of this, and so I appreciate it. So, Ian, all right, just give us a sense. What do you think is going to happen?
You know, I go back and forth on this. I mean, coming into the oral argument, I was all but certain they were going to strike the plan down because I thought Kennedy was mad that the Fifth Circuit didn't strike it down for him and he was going to take care of it. I think that's still the most likely outcome, but I think he also gave a ray of hope that at least he's going to give a stay of execution to this program by kicking it down to a lower court.
And who knows? Maybe we will see Fisher UT3 down the road. Ian Millhiser, thanks so much for your time today. Again, the book is Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for coming on. Have a great New Year and holiday season. We're fighting the war on Christmas here. So,
all right. Thanks so much for having me, Sam.
All right, bye-bye, Ian. All right, folks. We got it. We have to stay true to the war on Christmas. I can't be making excuses for, you know.
It's all Hanukkah, Kwanzaa to me, man.
That's right.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
And in
tree Holocaust.
Well, wait.
Is that what you're alluding to?
No, I'm going to talk to. Wait. So I'm going to just do this one piece because, folks, the battle is on. In the war on Christmas, and you know, as part of that, of course, we have posted the one of my favorite appearances on television on CNN, probably a decade ago now, when in the early stages, when there was we just had military advisors embedded in the war on Christmas, and were secretly bombing parts of the North Pole, and you know, we had special ops infiltrating
phase one.
Yeah. Teams of elves, at that time. And we have that on our YouTube channel, but, ladies and gentlemen,
not the invasion,
not the full on invasion of the war and the war on Christmas, a group of House Republicans have fired the latest shot in the war on Christmas. Representative Doug Lamborn from Colorado has introduced a resolution. And I just one of these guys is going to buck up and actually just force us all to celebrate Christmas. The resolution apparently is like one of those sense of the house resolutions that would, quote, say that the U.S. Congress recognize that the symbols and traditions of Christmas should be protected for use by those who celebrate Christmas. Now, we all know that those symbols and traditions are being threatened at their very core. You may not be able to go into your favorite department store and have the greeter there say, Merry Christmas. They may just say, Happy Holidays, or can I get you a cart? The resolution goes on to say that the U.S. House of Representatives strongly disapproves of attempts to ban references to Christmas and expresses support for the use of these symbols and traditions by, like I say, those who celebrate Christmas. I don't know where this banning reference to Christmas happens other than in my household, ladies and gentlemen. And in a 15-foot radius of where I walk. If you enter into my personal space, one of the first things I do at this time of year is demand a fealty to the banning of all Christmas symbols and references. So if I get somebody who, let's say, says, Merry Christmas, I'll go up to them and I'll get into their grill and I'll be like, no. Not to me, buddy.
I see like a bunch of like bodega guys. Well, fuck you, man. Whatever.
Right. And no. And if I walk by somebody and I hear like a little kid talking to his mom saying, this is what I want for Christmas. And it's within my circle of influence. I will go up to the kid and go, knock it off. It's awkward. And I'll tell you something. I know the right has made a big issue about Starbucks taking the snowflakes off their coffees and just having red. But if I see someone walking around with a coffee cup that is Christmas themed, I just go right up. I smack it out of their hands. And there's a certain percentage of times where that will scald them.
It's war.
But it's war.
Freedom isn't free.
Freedom is not free. Now, I will be fair enough to go say, like, after I scald them with that coffee, I will say, freedom is not free, and if you want another cup of coffee, I'm willing to pay for it. It's just going to be in my own Hanukkah-themed cup.
Right.
That I carry around.
Bunch of menorahs. Just sketch it on with them?
No, no. I walk around this time of season with three different sizes of cups. I got a 12-ounce, a 16-ounce, a 20-ounce cup. Hanukkah-themed.
I have the Mecca line.
There you go.
All mosques and minarets on mine.
But good for the House Republicans, because if they weren't waging this war, who would I be waging this war against? It's nothing more sad than watching a lonely warrior on the battlefield just shadow fighting himself.
You would be Don Quixote without the House Republicans.
Mm-hmm. All right, folks, going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Don't forget, our coverage tonight starts at what time, Matt?
Our coverage?
Yes, of the Republican presidential debate.
Eight, I think.
Well, keep an eye on our Twitter feed. We will have it live with Snark. I am anticipating, we'll talk about this in the fun app, but I'm anticipating some potential fireworks tonight, ladies and gentlemen. Literal fireworks, because it is in Vegas. All right, folks, we'll be right back in the fun app. 646-257-3920 if you want to be a part of the program. You can IM us via the app. We'll be right back after this.